Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for April 12th, 2015. I'm your host, Nathan McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, well, good to have y'all on. Just to kind of set the show up in about 20 minutes. David Mark, leading Washington author of books and articles and everything else, will be on to talk about a few topics with us this evening. So that'll be enjoyable. We've had David on so many times in the past, and this may be the first time he's been on since kind of around the holiday season. Good to have him back for the springtime, and that'll be on. But until then, we're going to talk about all kind of the topics. And first I want to talk about is the Senate. The Senate control, to me, in some ways, the way it's looking with Hillary Clinton being so strong as a candidate, the Senate race may actually be, or the Senate races across the country may actually be the more interesting of politics this time. And this year, Florida looks like it could be a good race if Marco Rubio decides not to run for re-election. Well, if he doesn't run for re-election, it's said that Jeff Atwater may be the leading Republican contender. He announced over the weekend in Politico that he's not going to run for Senate, going to just stay in the state house, or I'm sorry, the U.S. House. Pretty big deal, right, Catherine?
Yeah, I mean, it sounded like they were all ready. I mean, they practically had the, you know, website ready to roll out. It sounded like, you know, they'd been raising money, and or they were prepared to start raising money, and so, yeah, I think everybody was kind of shocked that he decided not to go for it.
Yeah. Tim, how big a surprise were you by this?
I was stunned. By the way, he's not in the House. He's the chief financial officer of the state of Florida.
Yeah, that's
right.
That was his
different vote. Yeah.
See, that was his deal. He just decided, out of stressing family concerns, that traveling back and forth to Washington, D.C. right now just wasn't in the cards. It really surprised a lot of people. He had been running extremely well in the polls, and front runners just don't normally do this. I got to mention here that the Democrats are cheering this one. First, Rubio, who we expect will announce for president tomorrow, and now Atwater, this is going to set off a chain reaction of mostly Republican elected officials moving around all over the place, shuffling the chairs, trying to move up or whatnot, and it could have something of a snowball effect. And in a presidential election year, Democrats could pick up several seats, all the way down to the legislative level, don't you think?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, usually these shakeups can – and I apologize for getting that wrong, and that actually makes a lot of sense. If a guy's happy in Florida and, you know, thinking, hey, if I stay in state politics and finance, then maybe I can run for, say, governor and not have to leave the state, go back.
Well, that was one of the things that was mentioned, was that it sets things up in 2018 for a battle between him and the agricultural commissioner.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting that that would be the seat to launch from governor for. Said that the lieutenant governor, Carlos Lopez Quintero, Ron DeSantis, Tom Rooney's looking at it, maybe some other congressmen, David Jolly, who just won office in that special election seemingly less than 2 years ago. There's more folks that are looking at this seat. And so depending on, you know, if you shuffle, let's say David Jolly were to win that, you know, run for that. I guess he wouldn't have to win it. He just have to run for it because he couldn't run for his House seat. That is one of the few swing districts in the country. to where a Democrat could win it. There's a seat that shakes out because he decides to run for that. Wonder if the Republican Congressional Committee will try to talk him out of it. Tim, what do you think? Do you think some of these people will be talked out of running because what they hold is more valuable in some ways?
Well, it'll depend on who's backing who. Wouldn't you think it might depend on who Senator Rubio might want to anoint as his successor, or it might depend on what Jeb Bush has to say, if especially he is the nominee. And I wanted to mention something else here, too. I think Atwater really means this, because if he looks at what I'm looking at, he could be bracketed out here. You got to figure, you know, Scott's going to be term limited. Well, he might run for the other U.S. Senate seat. That would pretty much stop Atwater there. Governor, if Rubio loses, he's going to be looking to do something.
Right.
I would say governor. Just a thought. This may be, you know, this may be it for Atwater.
Yeah. You know, this is a good shot. Now, and maybe he's looking at what might happen nationally with coattails and thinking maybe Florida's going to be more Democratic than one would think. Hillary Clinton's too strong, and the Republican nominee, at least the open seat nominee, is not going to do that well. One person that didn't, that's not looking at this seat, said that she's staying put is Attorney General Pam Bondi. Catherine, are you kind of surprised she's not looking at it? Because I think she's kind of more of a up-and-comer politician than some of these other names mentioned there in Florida.
Well, I think Tim makes a good point. There might be some fear that, you know, with Hillary in the Democratic nomination, that it might not be as easy a run as they would hope it to be, and they want to hold on to their whatever position they already have. But if all these people run, I'm so excited because I'll be able to use the line that I used, I think it was in 2010, it might have been in 2012, that the Republicans are the gift that keeps on giving. Because it's going to be a clown car. It'll be a clown car in Florida. It'll be a clown car in the presidential primary. I'm just really excited about it.
It gives us something to talk about, obviously. I mean,
yes.
If it's, you know, just cut and dry. And here's the other side of this, Democratic side. You have Patrick Murphy looking at it. You have Alan Grayson looking at it. But could the fact that the Republicans now aren't as strong as they look to be, is there a chance that more Democrats could look at this race, Tim?
Yeah, but who? What other
I don't know.
Democrats? It seemed like to me this thing was set up for Murphy. He seems to be the inside guy, the guy that's being helped by the National Party, the guy that a lot of National Democrats want to push out there and run for this thing. I think he's going to be the guy. I don't know what other Democrat we could even be thinking about, to be honest
now. Well, obviously there's a lot of folks in that state as far as state house seats and stuff. People that we may not necessarily know as, you know, we're Southern insiders, we're not Florida insiders. Maybe there's some state rep that's say in their mid, early third or late 30s, you know, just at that young age we had heard about that's really an up and comer. I mean, there could be somebody, you know, that we just aren't aware of.
They better have a lot of money of their own. That's all I know to say about that, because this late, even though it's, you know, it's still a while away, what, 19 months, still somebody is going to have to spend a whole ton of money to get the nomination and to win that Senate seat down there. It's a very expensive market, and unless
market.
They self-finance. Yeah, unless they're self-financing at this point, looks to me like Murphy has jumped out there early and gotten a lot of the organization and the money people and the party backing and all that kind of tied up. So,
yeah, and maybe it makes it easier for him. Isn't it interesting how this year in so many races. Democrats have one nominee, and, you know, it's nice and clean. We even saw some of this in, 2014 in some of the races, like, say, Kentucky Senate, Georgia governor, Alabama governor, where there's one candidate, but on the Republican side, there's this huge primary where they just beat each other up. I wonder if this is going to be a common thing that keeps happening over and over. Catherine, any thoughts there?
Well, you know, it is unusual because, I mean, it seems like in the past the Republicans have been more disciplined, but they don't seem to be as disciplined about that as they used to be, whereas the Democrats used to, you know, everybody would run, and we'd have these giant primaries. So I'm glad that we're showing a little bit of discipline. I think it's while I do think that primaries are a good way to elevate the conversation, I think that when you have too many, like the Republicans tend to have the last few cycles in the presidential races, it just muddles the water, and they just start fighting amongst each other, which benefits us, I think, in the long run.
The trickle-down effect is the important thing, David. We're looking at a possibility. Just because that water's not going to run, a strong possibility that four Republican congressmen from Florida could jump into that race. Well, that's going to leave their four seats open, and then you're going to have the inevitable bunch of state reps that are looking to move up, jumping into that. It's going to just compound itself as you go down the food chain there. This really throws things into a tizzy, especially in a presidential election year. Especially.
Yeah, I think that Jolly seat, if he runs for that suburban Tampa Bay seat, then that thing could really open up for the Democratic Party and be a pickup opportunity. And those are so, you know, few these days. Not that one or two seats here and there, switches the House, but, you know, it helps. And you got to make gains little by little. And that's one where I think I really would be looking forward, if I was the DCCC, to see what happens there in that congressional district. That one name I hadn't heard mentioned, Alex Sink, for any of these races. So I guess they've run her, I guess, what, three times now? And we're done then there if we're not hearing all these races. Well, let's move out of the South. And I don't, you know, like doing this a lot because it gets us off our theme, but this would kind of surprise me that this has happened in Wisconsin, not in a southern state. But Wisconsin, they vote, the Commission on Public Lands voted to have all the people that work for the Public Land Service not to talk about climate change. Just don't bring it up. If it's asked about, apparently you have to change the subject. You know, just stick your head in the ground. And to me, it's so crazy. I know that there's a Republican governor up there now, but not all the politicians by any means are Republicans. And I just, you'd think there'd be enough institutional moderation there that this couldn't happen in a state like Wisconsin, but it has. Tim, what is this saying about Wisconsin, and maybe what is this saying about Scott Walker's influence? Because this seems like a very Tea Party-ish, you know, right-wing move, if you will.
Yeah, it is, but he can get away with it because he's won election three times. In his mind, you know, in an ideologue's mind, if they win, that's justification for them to do whatever they feel like doing, no matter what it is, because, hey, they won. So yeah, they can just do anything, no matter what it is. And besides, didn't you know, if you don't mention climate change, it'll go away. Wink, wink. You got to see this more and more as these climate deniers and such as that take more control of some of these states and their legislatures and stuff. What you got to do is vote them out of office because, man, I don't even know what to say about this crowd. I mean, they denied basic science, you know, the female biology, and they deny drastic weather events that they see happening right in front of their eyes. And the only people I could see that would have a stake in denying this would be, you know, like the oil companies and stuff. Maybe they got all these guys bought off. I don't think all of them are. I think some of these clowns are true believers, and that's scary because you can't reason with them. You can't reason with an ideologue.
Well, they have
a similar law in Florida, and apparently Bill Maher did a thing on this week. Apparently someone in Florida did mention, some state official did mention climate change at some meeting or something, and was suspended from work for a period of time and couldn't go back to work until they went to some, like, like therapy, some
they
therapeutic.
They treated it like he's
crazy to be talking about climate change.
To me, it sounds like if somebody used a racial slur or sexual harassment, you would send them to some kind of, you know, class because of insensitivity. This guy's talking about basic science that, you know, 90% or more of all scientists agree on. And they were sent to a class. I mean, that's bizarre. Now, I want to ask, do y'all think this is just ironic or coincidence or whatever? When I was in college, I took a class called Environmental Studies. It was late in my college career. I was either the end of my second semester of my junior year or my senior year. Taught about all kind of environmental issues. Now, this was in college, learned all about this. Scott Walker did not finish college. Is this just coincidental, or is this just a guy that doesn't know any better because he didn't finish his education? Tim?
You know, it's hard to say. I can't believe we're even talking about stuff like this. 20 years ago in the Republican Party, we wouldn't have been talking about stuff like this. But you've got this new group, as this party moves further and further to the right, you've got this new group of people that are just pushing this type of agenda. And when they take these states over solidly, they can do this. They can enforce these crazy rules. They can change the school textbooks to make them read the way they think they should read. I mean, it's just wild. And outside of voting them out of office, I don't know what we can do about it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, you know, it's like all the books you read, and they change the rules and they rewrite history how they want it. I will say something interesting, and we're not going to get into the British elections, but I saw something where they're talking about the British elections, and it had this thing where all the candidates, how they feel about different issues. And every party, not only the Labor Party, but the Conservative Party, they all agree on, you know, environmental issues. They're all much more like the Democratic Party here, and they believe in climate change and think something needs to get done. And it's so funny that this is an issue where pretty much everybody needs to be on the same page, and we're not. I mean, we've got one party that won't even discuss it.
In Great Britain, some of that leadership may come from the monarchy because Prince Charles is a, you know, adamant environmentalist, and, you know, they may get some of that leadership from him.
Yeah, but do you think a lot of the Tea Party types would listen to a monarch here? Not that we have one, but I'm saying they're so, you know,
their
way.
Absolutely not. In fact, we know that it's the opposite. Like if the president believes something, they will not. I mean, like you've said before, if the president said the sky was blue, Tea Party would say, "Oh no, the sky's green."
Do these people see what's going on in California? Do they understand that? Do they understand how this is going to affect them all? Because it's going to hit everybody in this country in the pocketbook. something like 50% of all the agricultural things in this country are grown in that state out there, and they're running out of water, and the only reason is climate change. There wasn't enough snow this year, and it didn't produce enough water for the reservoirs and stuff.
And, you know, it's not just the United States either. California provides food to, you know, many countries. I mean, it's a food source for, you know, an international food source.
Not to mention there's 39 million people there.
Right.
They're like the fifth strongest economy in the world, comparing to other countries now. They're fifth.
Yeah, and that's something interesting, and I've talked about that before just in everyday life when I talk about on the show. A lot of people need to realize that a lot of times if California passes a law, it affects everybody, because if you look at some of the products you buy, there'll be some safety regulation. Go, what's up with this? And you see on some kind of, you know, when you read your book or whatever, when you buy this, it says, oh, due to California law, XYZ. And so they will do whatever meets the California law, since so much of the American population lives there. And then you've got California, which has moved very far to the left, while the country in some places moved very far to the right. And the further the country gets away from California on certain things, it doesn't matter, because the businesses are going to cater to California because of the population. And so it's interesting to see that dynamic happening.
Well, David, let's just look at what one of our presidential candidates said when she weighed in on it. Carly Fiorina, talking about running for president. She said, oh, the problem is in California. Guess what, guys? It's all the environmentalists' fault. It's their fault. I know you're scratching your head on that, right? But she's saying, well, the Republicans out there wanted to build several more reservoirs. The only problem was it's on protected federal and state land, and the environmentalists stopped it, or we'd have had more water. No, you would have just had about four or five more empty reservoirs.
Yeah.
It's idiotic to say, well, if we'd dug more reservoirs, we'd have had more water. No, you wouldn't have. You got reservoirs, plenty of them. You just don't have the water to put in them. That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. And she said it with a straight face, and she's thinking about running for the Republican nomination for president, and that party's full of people that think stuff like that, and it's not even logical, is it?
No,
yeah,
I mean,
ridiculous.
Obviously, no, I've never heard of anybody being pro or anti-water as far as, like, we can't build reservoirs. I mean, I guess that, you know, the Republican Party, a lot of times, I think they think oil is a more valuable resource to the human race than water, and so therefore Democrats are anti-oil pipes. Well, I guess they're anti-water pipes too, which is just nuts. You know, collecting water that falls from the sky, I don't know anybody that's really anti that. Well, let's go ahead and welcome on our guest this time. I got my wires a little crossed, so if you're thinking, well, where was David Mark for the last 3 or 4 minutes, blame David McLaughlin, not David Mark. But welcome back to the show.
My pleasure. Good to be back with you.
Yeah, good to have you on. Well, we're going to talk about just a lot of different topics, because some serious and important and some kind of more fun and you know, different and entertainment, if you will. But let's start off with the serious. And you wrote an article recently on the candidate of the day, if you will. And so I'm going to start off by letting Tim ask questions on that. And if Catherine wants to follow up from there, I'll let her. Go ahead, Tim.
Sure. Well, good evening, sir. Thank you for being on with us tonight. And it is appropriate to start with that and to mention that article that you wrote. First of all, because it's going to come into play quickly, how would you rate Hillary Clinton as the campaigner?
Middling at best. That's not to say that she's right or wrong on the issues. I'll leave that to other folks. But I think even Hillary Clinton's staunchest supporters would agree that campaign retail politics is not her strong suit. Her speeches often seem kind of forced and overwrought. She's just not a natural. She's much better one-on-one, and that's clearly why she's starting out her campaign, going to meet small groups in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, et cetera. But I just don't think it's her greatest strength. Now, it may not matter because fundamentals may much of the campaign, the electorate, may be working in her favor, but she's mediocre at best.
Do you think she has learned from past mistakes?
It remains to be seen. Her rollout so far has been reasonably smooth. She was late in delivering her campaign video to announce her candidacy, but really the only people who really care about that kind of thing are campaign or political journalists. So I wouldn't put too much stock in that. The biggest advantage she clearly has is that she's not facing a strong Democratic primary opponent, at least not at this point. And most of the names that are out there, whether it's former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, former Virginia Governor Jim Webb, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, or a couple of others, there's not much there, nobody there who could really give her a run for her money. So I don't think it's that she's so strong as a candidate. I think she's just, to adapt to the cliche, the last woman standing for the first time.
Well, you know, she's been around for a very long time in national politics. And the available polling indicates that most people in this country, if they're telling the truth in these polls, have pretty much already made up their mind about her, whether they like her or don't like her. And especially just she's universally known to most people, which leaves very few undecideds in these polls. So do you think the needle will be moved at all pro or con, or is she pretty much where she is and that's where she's going to be in the polling?
That's a great point. And she has the one thing that other candidates crave, and that's name recognition. On the Republican side, you see these guys just falling, tripping over one another, trying to get their name out there, appearing on all these shows, on Fox, et cetera, whether it's Marco Rubio or Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, or many of the others. Jeb Bush might be the only one who even comes close, but even he's not as universally well known. And I think her campaign really is betting on the fact that the electorate has changed enough that people are decided. She's probably not going to persuade many people. What she has to do is convince the Democratic faithful to come out and vote on Election Day, in the primaries, of course, and then in November. And in her campaign video, I think that was very well reflected, where you see images of, you might say, a diverse America, where you have Hispanic young business people, you have an African-American husband and wife, a woman is pregnant, you have a gay couple, you have all these different images that are meant to reflect the Obama coalition that won two national elections. And I think it's a pretty good bet on their part that if they can just make sure those kind of voters turn out, they can probably win.
Well, that's an excellent answer to my question. I thank you for that. And I'm going to pass it over to Catherine because I know she's chomping at the bit to talk about some things with Hillary Clinton. Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, I went back and read a piece that you didn't send us a link to, but that I found.
Okay.
And about people calling her disingenuous.
Right.
I mean, I'm a big fan of Hillary Clinton's. I'm not a national elections person. I try to focus on local stuff just because everybody talks about national, and I feel like the local is more important for me, for my own goals. But, you know, I'm a big fan. I was a big fan in 2008, and kind of in, though I wasn't publicly endorsing her, I did find myself defending her from time to time because I felt like there wasn't a big difference between her and then Senator Obama. But do you think this disingenuous? I mean, I think that goes hand in hand with what you were saying about her campaign. I think that she's guarded.
Yeah.
And I think that may come off as disingenuous sometimes. So do you think that those that guarded and, you know, I don't want to call her disingenuous because you told me not to. But do you think that will be a problem for her? I think, while I do think she is very authentic, I think her authenticity is sometimes lost.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think for the most part, anybody who thinks she's disingenuous already probably is going to vote against her.
Well, that's true.
Probably so it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. In that case, I think where it really could hurt her is if some new information emerges, say on Benghazi or the White House, her email system when she was Secretary of State, or something of that nature that's really revelatory that we didn't know before, and it looks like she was trying to cover something up. Now, there's a lot of ifs. I'm not alleging anything there. I have no inside information. But otherwise, I think people kind of get that that's who she is. She's not Mrs. Open. She's not like her husband, who really wore his emotions on his face. She's just very careful about that. And I think, again, she's probably got enough support. Even if her voters don't love her, they're not passionate about her the way they were for, say, Barack Obama, she's good enough to put it that way. And so even if she is disingenuous, I'm not even sure it hurts her that much.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I do think there's a lot of people, there's a groundswell of people who supported her before the primaries in 2008 who have been just, and then went on to, you know, wholeheartedly support the president when he was running. But I think there's a lot of people who have been, I mean, maybe it's just my Facebook feed, but that have been waiting for this and are really excited about it. So.
Yeah.
I think I think there are a fair amount who are going to be sort of like, yeah, whatever, I'll vote for the Democrat because I always do. But I think there's this groundswell of support of people, you know, and a large part of it is just the fact that she's a woman, and it would be the first, you know, I mean, I think we have all always talked about that. So I think I'm thinking that may balance out this sort of ennui of some of the people. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
it's interesting. The campaign is talking about really targeting some states that Democrats have had in their crosshairs, their sights for some time, but haven't won in. Although, like North Carolina, which Obama did win in 2008, but then lost in 2012. And thinking that there, like you're saying, there would be enough excitement. They've even mentioned Georgia at times, which I think would be a tough lift. You three of you could explain a lot better than me, but they think they've expressed the opinion, at least kind of behind the scenes, that the electorate is changing enough there. Potentially you get more Hispanic voters, the African American voting pool is growing, even Asian Americans, et cetera, to possibly make it competitive. That may be just wishful thinking, but it'll be interesting to watch.
Well, let me just say, if they do that, will they please not wait until like 10 days before the election to do that?
Yeah.
Because it's really frustrating when they do that. Like, because that's what happened in 2014. Like 10 days before the election, all this money came pouring in. Well, thanks. You know, we appreciate that. But it would have been nice to have it 3 months ago instead. You know, I mean,
right. And
I'm not turning it away or anything, but it is frustrating when you're working, you know, on the ground and you've been, you know, struggling trying to pay people or get ads out or whatever you are, whatever it is that you're doing, and then, you know, a flush of money comes in, but you really don't have time to spend it.
Right. You have to really start that kind of on-the-ground work early, and there's no guarantee it's going to pay off. It's like making a financial investment. You're looking
exactly
down the road, and it might work. You hope you perform your due diligence, but there's no guarantee. And then if you do that and it doesn't work, donors get mad at you, and there's all kinds of problems. You can see why they wouldn't do it, but it might be
worth
your time.
Oh, I understand it. It's just frustrating on our end.
Sure. Understand.
Okay, David, on to you.
Yeah.
David McLaughlin.
Well, so
David, the other
yes.
David.
We've covered
the leading Democratic candidate. Now, the Republican side, not as clear-cut, but I guess if the polls and the finance reports are to be believed, Jeb Bush right now is still the leading contender. You wrote a piece this past week for the Washington Post on him as well. Your last, I guess, all-night assignment. And tell us a little bit about that piece and then how you think it'll play into this year's election, even though it's been 16 years ago.
Yeah, this is going back a ways, but I was just kind of struck when Jeb Bush was announcing his candidacy, and as I've just been watching him on the campaign trail a bit, he likes to raise the issue of affirmative action, and when he was governor going back a decade and a half, that he issued an executive order basically banning affirmative action in higher education in Florida, and he offset it with, you know, admitting the top 20% of high school seniors more financial aid and some other measures. But this was deeply controversial at the time, to the point that two then state lawmakers, African-American state lawmakers, staged an overnight sit-in in his gubernatorial office. And I was then working with the AP, and I happened to be among the reporters who toughed it out through the night. And so, admittedly, last time I stayed up all night. I'm usually an early-to-bed kind of guy, but that was quite a story. And it's just it's an issue that I think could have resonance for him on the campaign trail, because it can play well with conservatives, but it could also raise the issue of executive action, and it's arguably more unilateral than what President Obama did on immigration some months back. And so, well, it'll be fascinating to see how it plays in the primaries, and then if he makes it that far, the general election.
Yeah, and Kendrick Meek, I guess he went on to higher office, and he was the Senate nominee, so he really did move up from there. The other gentleman, I guess, is pretty big in Jacksonville politics. Go ahead.
Kendrick Meek did go on to serve 8 years in Congress, and he was actually the Democratic nominee against Marco Rubio in 2010. That was a three-man race. It's kind of fun writing this piece, reminiscing about my time in Tallahassee, which I have very fond memories of. I used to go up to Georgia a bit, down to Thomasville, down in the I guess that's the southwest corner of the state. Some of those areas, so got to spend a good amount of time in that region.
Yeah, well, so that'll be something to watch. And I guess you've been writing all these national pieces, and you actually looking at the Hillary Clinton piece. You're writing, I guess, on a pretty frequent basis for the Christian Science Monitor on a blog you and your co-author do. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. We write a weekly column. It's called Decoding DC, or it's part of their Decoding DC page on the Christian Science Monitor site. And they asked us to do this. And what we try to do is pick out terms that come up during the campaign season, something that maybe one of the candidates utters or that gets said about the candidates. And in this case, we were going after this notion of fundamentals, how much candidate quality really matters, like we were discussing at the outset here with Hillary Clinton. Even though she's not really a great candidate, again, even her supporters might say that, but the fundamentals are working her way. The electoral college math is going in her favor. Unemployment is down. GDP is up. These economic factors, among others, would indicate that she's got a pretty good chance of winning, all things being equal. The race is more than a year and a half off. But it's just interesting for us because it's a raging debate among political scientists who say you can really kind of calculate and game out how elections are going to go, and then campaign professionals and journalists who say candidates matter much more. I think it's probably a combination thereof, but we'll continue with this column, and we're planning to turn to an e-book, actually, as a follow-up to our book on political language sometime in 2016.
All right. Got your next topic for the blog, and it can be our next topic for the show. When I got you to agree to come on the show, I sent you a link to Rand Paul's campaign store, and it's this campaign store. I mean, I guess it's the Target or the Walmart of campaign stores. It's got so many aisles and categories and sections. But my favorite is fun stuff. So I want you to decode what fun stuff means. because I'll be honest, a few of the things on there I might call weird stuff. But what in the world is he doing with all these items on the store? I mean, who's going to buy a $1,000 copy of the Constitution that he signed, or this Hillary's hard drive thing for $100 for, I guess, a gag gift? What's he thinking?
Yeah, it doesn't sound very fun to me either, but those kind of sites are meant to go to the party faithful. It's not like somebody who's going to spend $1,000 on that can't get a copy of the Constitution. You could buy one, you could just get one for free. Just go on the internet and get one. It's a way of supporting the candidacy. It's a knickknack. I kind of think it cheapens the campaign a bit, and you actually have to be really careful with this because it can be like an in-kind contribution to the campaign, and you're not really allowed to run campaigns as for-profit businesses. So I'm sure they have lawyers vetting this, but they've got to watch themselves. I think it's probably not going to help them that much, but we will see how it works out for them.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll help them at all, but it's got some products in here. Tim, do you think the guy's opening a bar? I mean, how many beer mugs and things can one store sell for a campaign?
That's a good question, but I don't know why you guys call this stuff silly. Don't you want your own sandals that you're standing with Rand Paul? That's got to be my personal favorite, because if you're standing in those sandals, nobody's going to see what those sandals say, for starters.
I thought the same thing. You couldn't even see it. But I love the beer stein with the dog on it. It's the new Spud McKenzie. Poor dog, you never signed up for this. And Catherine, I'll ask you one here. How exactly does the U.S. Postal Service send you the giant card for you to fill out? And then how do you get the postage on it to send it to your person that you want to say happy birthday to? I mean, this thing, if this woman's, let's say, 5'5", this is like a 3-foot card.
I know. Well, let me just tell you that I used to have, and I may still have it, a transistor radio in the shape of a peanut that had Jimmy Carter's picture on it.
Okay.
That was some kind of campaign gift in the 70s. So this
so
is not
I'm
new.
Sure that there's some, yeah, some crazy ones. But you know, the NSA blocker, I think, Catherine, you had it requested one of those at one point. We're emailing back and forth about this. Now, getting back to another part of the store, the less fun stuff, I guess, David. There's, you know, we used to have bumper stickers and they would say the name of the person. Now, you know, we had W for a while, and then President Obama had the colorful O logo. Rand Paul has a silhouette of himself with, like, Rand next to it. And the silhouette is just really different. Do you think this is going to be his campaign logo, or what do you think of there?
Yeah, it is kind of dark in some ways, but that kind of fits his message. It's almost like a doomsday message. That's certainly how his father was, Ron Paul, the former congressman and presidential candidate. Rand Paul has tried to be more upbeat, but he's got a really sharp side to him. We saw that in a couple of his TV interviews, particularly with female journalists, which seem to, for whatever reason, rub him the wrong way or something. So I think it kind of reflects how his campaign is going. I don't know if that's really good for him.
Yeah, and actually, now that I look at car decor, I don't see that silhouette logo, so it may be in another section. And by the way, Tim, to go along with your flip-flops, for $70, you can get a set of I Stand with Rand car mats. And you have bare feet on the car mat, so I guess it's for all the people that drive barefooted to support Rand Paul. Because we know it's hard to drive barefooted. I have a feeling, folks, this store is going to continue to get products, and we almost could do like a recurring thing, like with George Bush's artwork, Rand Paul's store, or maybe some other candidate will try to up the ante and find more unusual gifts. I don't care if they're Democrat, Republican, third party. If you can beat this collection of stuff, send me a link. We'll talk
about
it.
David, wouldn't you love to go to church and maybe the air conditioner's messing up, so you show everybody how smart you are and you pull out your Rand Paul fan? There's
yes,
the keeper,
Boston
huh?
Nickname.
Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah. I thought it was like, yeah, that old man.
That'll be fascinating. Again, though, you got to be really careful this with campaign lawyers. You can get in trouble if you look like you're trying to curry favor, because then you also have contributors who might try and come up and give contributions through the back door. So I'm sure they vetted this, but it just seems like a recipe for trouble in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
but I always
this
think
gets
we're
right
safe
into
scenarios.
Yeah, this gets right into your old work at campaign and elections when you talk about campaigning. And this is right in your wheelhouse for that. So I guess if you do an article on Rand Paul's store, anything with it, or any of these stores, definitely send us a link, David. We'll discuss it in detail on the next show. Well, one more topic we wanted to get with you on was Clay Aiken's documentary show. I don't know how many episodes it's going to have, but it's going to have multiple episodes on the Esquire Network. It debuted this past Tuesday. I DVR'd it. Esquire Network, it has two of my favorite shows. Friday Night Tights, that is an absolute bizarre show to watch. My son and I love it. And The Running of the Bulls from Pamplona comes on Esquire. So this week I found out that Tim is not only deprived of the Clay Aiken show, but also these two shows, and so they need to get Esquire on more places, but it's on Esquire. And it's, a documentary show looking at the campaign, and so obviously had to plan this thing out. David, in your work both in D.C. and California, two places where this might be more of a topic, was there any buzz around the show?
I knew it was filming and that it was in the works, but Clay Aiken didn't come that close to winning against the congresswoman he was running against, the Republican Renee Elmers. So I think it's got a bit of buzz. It's probably more a way to revive his show business career, although he ran a sincere candidacy and he really tried hard. Maybe he'll run again, but there's a lot of former congressional candidates out there, losing congressional candidates. I think it's going to be hard to generate that much interest in it.
Yeah. Now, let me ask, and I can actually open this up to Tim and Catherine as well. As I watched it, I actually enjoyed the first episode, learned a few things and whatnot, but I did get the sense that somebody might have approached him about the show and the campaign at the same time. Like, hey, if you run for office, we can do the show. Did any of y'all think that may have been how this thing unfolded? It was do the show, do the campaign so we can have a show.
I didn't get that feeling, but I found him to be, I watched, like about half of that first episode, and I found him to be quite authentic and genuine, and I thought, if he'd been elected, he probably would have been a pretty good congressman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that he had some good ideas. He seemed to be, he's apparently worked with disabled children for a long time, and he felt like that was really important, and he also, I thought that he was quite, I don't want to say passionate because that's a little too strong, but I was impressed, actually, and I think it was a little bit sad that there were a lot of people who didn't even, were so celebrity happy about meeting him and getting selfies with him that didn't even realize he was running. And I think that was a disappointment to him too. I think he felt like his celebrity, while you might think that it would help you, it was actually sort of a barrier in some ways. So, I didn't get the feeling that it was like a staged gig, but maybe I'm just, gullible.
I do think even he approached it, and once he decided to do it, he approached the campaign in the right way from what we gathered on the first episode. I'm just saying he could have, it could have been put together that way. And that happens a lot. I mean, what was the fellow, George Plimpton, that made all the money writing the books that when he'd try out for this team or that team? And he tried out for the teams, obviously, to get the books written. Not that he shouldn't try hard when he got there. So So, I mean, I just, that came up as an idea. But,
right.
David, did you get to see the first episode, or what were some of your thoughts?
Yeah, I saw the trailer on it, so I saw bits and pieces of it. Yeah, I think he was a decent candidate. The problem is it was just in a tough uphill district.
Yeah.
It used to be more Democratic, but it got redrawn after the last round of redistricting to favor this Republican, Renee Elmers. And actually now she's facing a Republican primary challenge for allegedly not being conservative enough on a few some issues. Yeah, local Republican chairman. She had in the past supported a 20-week abortion ban piece of legislation, and earlier this year heard some other Republican female lawmaker said, you know, maybe this isn't the best image for the party to have, and we shouldn't do this as one of our first bills. And for her efforts, she's now facing a primary challenge from the right. So I don't think we'll be hearing that kind of talk from her anymore. And that might be the only way that a Democrat could come in and win if somehow she got knocked out. But even that's unlikely.
Well, it will be a better year. I mean, obviously, it was a tough year. It was kind of surprising in that district. Keith Crisco, the gentleman that Clay Aiken, I mean, it was like a 50-50 race. It was like a recount. You know, over it on the show how, you know, Keith Crisco passed away due to an accident during the recount process. He was just about to have, they're kind of have like a conversation where Keith Crisco said, yeah, Clay, can you won by how many of our votes? But he was a solid candidate, too. Brad Crone, kind of our North Carolina guy on the Kudzu Vine, he came on, his friends with Keith Crisco, talked about that right after. And so it's kind of like this district wasn't very good for Democrats, but then it had solid candidates to run for it, which it was an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, that was really tragic when that happened with Keith Crisco. It was like a ladder accident or something like that. This is going back a little ways. It's I have to catch up with all the episodes, having just seen the first one. But that was really unfortunate, and that kind of put a pall over the campaign, and it was an uphill battle to begin with. But North Carolina is a changing electorate, just like we're discussing in Georgia. That's definitely going to be a target for Democrats in coming presidential elections, and that district might actually be open to win to victory by a Democratic candidate, whether it's Clay Aiken or somebody else. That's an open question. It'll be interesting to see also what he does next, if he stays in that district, if he tries to go back to Hollywood. But he does seem like he's pretty committed to his community and wants to help people.
Yeah, that was the impression I got.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, David, I want to thank you again for coming on the show. Are there any, like, writings or anything you're about to publish or any interviews you're going to do elsewhere you want to promote?
Well, you mentioned the Christian Science Monitor column. I will have some more. I'll tell you what, I'll send them along as they kind of – they're often just based on what's coming up at the news at any given moment. So I should have some more soon to be able to promote, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, well, we'll keep reading what we see coming up and have you on again throughout the year, because always a great guest when you're on.
Well, thanks very much. I always appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, that was David Mark, freelance writer, writes Dog Whistle, political, book of terms. That's his most famous work. He also, Christian Science Monitor we just talked about. Well, let's kind of see if we can get another topic in. And there was a really interesting poll that came out this past week. MSNBC and Telemundo, they basically, I guess, oversampled in another poll Latino voters. And they saw that Democrats have a 31% advantage in party ID, 47-16%. So just 16% of Latinos consider themselves Republican. 36 is independents. And then you look about, even if you look at, Latinos that say, oh, I'm conservative, they still don't want to call themselves Republican. And if you look at, trends and
you know, birth rates, changing rates of demographics in the country. This is pretty disturbing. Tim, we knew it wasn't getting good for Republicans, but is this worse than we thought?
No, I think it's about right. Romney, as you know, got beat by 44 points in the Latino vote, 71 to 27, I believe. And we can do the math there. If only 16% of Latinos are Republican, that means that about 41% of his vote in this group was from those independent, or those who call themselves independent. So there's votes to be gotten there by the Republicans. Might take a candidate like Bush, who speaks fluent Spanish, whose wife is Hispanic, or Rubio, Cruz, somebody like that. I don't know about the preppy white boys. And no, don't write me nasty letters. I don't have anything in general against preppy white boys. Unless they're running for president, then they've got a problem with certain groups of voters, Latino voters being among them. Especially if your ideas for immigration include self-deportation, right? But it's not where I thought it would be. Looks good for the Democrats going forward if they can hold this group of voters, because it's growing. It's growing by like a percent every 2 years as a percentage of the electorate. That sounds pretty good, don't it, guys?
It does.
Yeah, if you look at a state like, say, Texas, you know, California's pretty much already out of play for the Republicans. Texas would be the next big prize. Florida's right now a swing state. You could put that one. That could become quickly like California, Georgia, another big state. Because some of the states, Illinois and New York, are the Democratic column. I mean, it completely changed the
don't
dynamics.
Don't forget Nevada. Don't forget Colorado, where the Hispanic
Arizona
has actually carried us to victory. You know,
yeah.
Arizona's, I guess, when you look at the next few states to flip or turn really purple, you know, Georgia, Arizona, South Carolina, I always mentioned, is three of them, and you know, obviously Arizona would be, the Hispanic population would be what changed it more. So, you know, it's funny you said, Tim, you're saying, you know, a lot of times those conservative voters that don't identify them as GOP, they don't identify themselves as in the Republican Party, but, you know, kind of vote Republican. Isn't that a lot of times in the South with a lot of white voters? You look at the number of independents, and they say, we're independent, but then 99% of the time they vote for the Republican.
No, they say, I'm not a Republican, I'm a conservative. I vote for the candidate, not the party, blah, blah, blah. It just
there's
so happens that
every other tax commission
for the candidate, it's a Republican. So,
one token race every other election they might vote for the Democrat. And, okay. Catherine, your thoughts on this poll?
Well, I think it's good news for me, because I'm a Democrat. And I think that it should be notice. It should put the GOP on notice that, you know, they have to soften up if they want to be able to win going forward in the next, you know, maybe not this cycle, but as far as like movement building, they need to change their tune.
Yeah,
they
it's
need
so
to come into the 21st century.
Yeah, it's so funny. It's some quarters, I think, if you said, you know, if we want to win, and you were talking to the Republicans, if might be the word they argue about. It wouldn't be how we win, or be like, well, do we want to win? If we had to do X, Y, Z, it would be like selling our soul. And we don't want to do that, and so we'll just lose and be right. But in democracy,
well, I think that I think
right
that it's that they feel like they can convince people that they're right, and you know, and then get them to vote their way. The problem is that the math is just not going to work for them. It's not going to work unless they unless, like they said, they come into the 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, right now they've gerrymandered so many congressional maps, they can still win some of those races. But the statewide races where they can't redraw the lines and national races, it doesn't work anymore. Well, I want to thank our guest tonight again, David Mark, for coming on the show. Next week, looks like we're going to have some really good Florida talk, and obviously, as you can tell, that's very timely. Bernard Jennings, who's been on the show once before, he's going to come back and spend 20, 30 minutes with us on, you know, a lot of Florida talk, so we're looking forward to that. So, for tonight, been the Cudsey Vine.
Good night,
guys.
Thanks, everybody.